No matter how much you hate me or how much you may disagree with me, I want you to know that I believe you have value and you had a right to be born.
That's Kristen Hawkins talking about showing compassion to people who get angry with her about her work to end abortion. She experiences a lot of hostility as she promotes life on progressive college campuses. Kristen is the president of Students for Life, and she spends a lot of time equipping college students to defend the preborn and support women who are in a pregnancy crisis. The pro-life movement has been criticized a lot for not caring about the women who consider having an abortion, because these women are often struggling with difficult circumstances. But we do care, and we're going to talk about how we can help these women and save their children. There are so many lies spread about abortion, how it helps women, how it is their right, which is, of course, heartbreaking. We're going to unpack those lies today and learn how to respond to them compassionately. I remember a time when I extended an offer to meet with people in the abortion industry to talk with them on something I thought we agreed on, and that is to make abortion rare. And a couple of women responded to their credit. And one woman I met with, she walked into my office and she was trembling. And I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "Well, my friends said you were going to put a voodoo hex on me," to which I laughed. And my woman colleague who was with me in the meeting, she laughed and she looked at us like, "Why are you laughing?" And we said, we don't do voodoo hexes. And it was so amazing. I quickly said, "Do you know what we believe as Christians?" And she said, "No, no one's ever taken the time to tell me." So I said, "May I have 15 minutes and I'll just give you the kind of the thumbnail of what we believe in Jesus." And she said, "Please do. No one's ever taken the time to do that." And it was a lovely conversation. And to her credit, it made a difference in her. And as I mentioned, Kristen Hawkins fights diligently for women and the preborn child. You're going to hear her passion and her bold goals for the pro-life movement. She speaks across the country and educates youth on the tragedy of abortion. This was a fascinating discussion with Kristen. So let's jump into the conversation on today's Refocus with Jim Daly. Well, Kristen, let's start with the obvious question. What got you going to be an advocate, to be a really strong voice for the pro-life movement? What was the occurrence that you kind of went, "Wow, I got to do something"?
I think everyone has those kind of stories. Those of us who have committed our lives to the pro-life movement. For me, it was a simple ask in my life, where a woman that I went to church with was a part-time accountant at a pregnancy resource center. I was looking to graduate high school early. I decided to graduate school a year early, and so I had to get all of my volunteer hours in within one summer to graduate with honors. And so I just put out a call at church that Kristen's available for slave labor all summer. Whatever you need, I have to fill up all of these volunteer hours. And she came up to me and said, "You know, I work at this women's center. Do you want to come and intern for me at the women's center?" And I would love to be able to say today that I knew exactly what I was getting myself into, that I knew, you know, really fully the issue of abortion and the violence of abortion, but I didn't really know that much. I largely felt that I was pro-life.
Right.
I grew up in a church. We didn't talk about much, but as I mentioned, we had those bulletin inserts, so I knew a little bit. But, you know, I was kind of one of those people of, yes, I'm against abortion, but in this case, or maybe in this case. And so when I walked into that pregnancy center in Steubenville, Ohio, the women there were just so excited to have me there, because I was the youngest volunteer by a couple of decades. And they just poured into me for an entire summer and really trained me in how to counsel some of the women who were coming into the clinic, my age, even younger. Yes, I did the menial intern task of reorganizing the supply room and teaching everyone how to use
and you probably did a really good
job. The computer, yes. But
they were going, "Wow, she's good."
Yeah. But no, it was it for me, I remember distinctly walking out of that pregnancy center the first day, you know, with the thought in my head of, why doesn't anyone talk about this?
Yeah.
Abortion's happening thousands of times in a day and no one talks about
it. But in that context, you did get an opportunity to begin counseling, and that really sparked you, I think, right? What happened, and how old were you then? And pretty courageous, because of your youthfulness, that somebody would have said, well, let's put you in the counseling role. Because that's heavy.
Yeah, that's not something normally you would see pregnancy centers do. I think Sharon, the director of the center, probably saw something in me, and I would sit in with her for counseling sessions. And then by the end of the summer, I was able to do some of them by myself. I was 15, nearly 16. And it was hard because I grew up in pretty sheltered, stable family, a great family. There was no financial poverty, no spiritual poverty. And then to meet some of these women who came into the center, many of them had already had abortions in their life. Mm. They're coming for a pregnancy test. Sometimes I knew they were, I'd say, you're not, do you really think you're pregnant? Or she was coming there because she wanted to talk to somebody, that she needed some diapers for her two-year-old. Her boyfriend was abusing her. And just hearing these stories and realizing that abortion isn't this great solution for any of these women, no matter how terrible these circumstances are, it's this Band-Aid. And in a lot of ways, it let the abuse continue on in her life.
Yeah, and in that regard, I mean, I think the statistics show when they do the post survey work that women are far worse off after abortion, emotionally, spiritually, in every way. So that's why you are there. Students for Life, it's about 18 years old now, so it's becoming an adult. Yes.
We can vote, apparently.
It can vote. That's about it. But in that context, I mean, that's a long time going after this. What have you seen in that movement? You're going after students. Why? Mm. Why is it important to be on these college campuses where there's, pretty much monolithic thinking about the abortion issue, which is every woman should have the right to terminate the life of their baby. That's a hostile environment to get into. What's it like?
Yeah, I don't mind hostile environments. I actually enjoy them. I find that I thrive in those environments. So,
And what's the mission of Students for Life?
I think when you look at the mission of Students for Life, you look at back at the history of social reform movements in our country, and in order to have great cultural change take effect, you have to win over a generation of young people. That is what the left has done so brilliantly. I mean, today we've seen the chickens come home to roost on our college campuses. And this wasn't just like 2 years ago. People shouldn't tend to think like, oh, it's gotten really bad since COVID. No, this is what they've been teaching our young people for decades in schools. And now they're in college and now they're adults. No wonder why they're confused about their gender or think that they have no value or purpose in life, because you've told them that, right? For two decades while they were in school. And so I know, and I think about my life and the time I spend away from my four kids, my husband, and, why am I doing this work and getting on these planes and going to these crazy places that people don't want me, right? I know that there's nothing greater than I can do to build this generation up, these young people who they are the ones having the conversations on campuses with the women who are most targeted by the abortion industry. They're saving lives. They're helping moms and families find success. But then these are the ones also leading the pro-life movement. Now we have, tens of thousands of graduates at Students for Life who are now running their own pregnancy centers, starting their own maternity homes, working for members of Congress. They are literally everywhere. They're running for office. They're being elected to office. This is the generation that's going to hopefully achieve the full mission of the pro-life movement, which wasn't just reverse Roe versus Wade. Right. It's to end abortion, to make it unthinkable and unavailable. That's really going to be this generation's legacy.
Man, may it be so. That's what we have all worked for so long.
What we're praying for.
Let's get down to some practical storytelling. You're there helping students in very practical ways. You're lecturing and talking and debating and doing Q&As at, again, Berkeley and Dartmouth.
Doing TikToks.
And I've seen many of those, and you do a great job. Tell us about that component, what you practically do to help these female students in their point of need. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that comes out in the data, I didn't mention it a moment ago, but if a woman has just one person that says, I will help you through this, they're far more likely to have the child instead of being alone. If they're alone, they're desperate, they're looking for way out. But they say, if I just had one person saying, we can do this together.
And she'll tell you that the Pregnancy Center, I wrote a book back in 2010 where I interviewed Students for Life leaders, young women we met on campuses, all who had an abortion story. And every story, every person we interviewed, the difference between life and death was one person. Yeah. If she was able to find one person to tell her she didn't have to have the abortion. Not that they had all the solutions and all the answers to everything going on in her life at that time, but just saying you don't have to do it. You're absolutely right. And I think that's what's important about what we do at Students for Life every day on campuses, where we're going out, hosting events, starting conversations. We measure our conversations. We measure our conversion. We have a 10% conversion rate last semester on campuses.
That's fantastic.
And that's hard to get young people to admit that they were wrong to your face. Online, the conversion rate's always much higher because you're just committing it to yourself. But then, you're not just hosting these events and starting the conversation. It's building up these groups, Students for Life groups on high school, college campuses that are this remaining force that are constant. They're hosting educational displays, talking about the violence of abortion, talking about the resources in their community, and then pressuring this university themselves to change their own policies to support pregnant and parenting women to be that one person. So we have tons of stories of that.
Yeah, and I want to hear.
One person meeting that girl.
Yeah, and I guess the good way to describe that is you try to be that friend.
Yeah, that's right.
You try to be that one person, that one entity that can help her make the better decision. Give us a couple of those stories of women that you've helped.
Yeah, one of the stories that is a recent story President Trump highlighted a couple years ago, I didn't know about until I was watching it on TV, and I was like, why didn't anyone tell me this? one of our students in Fresno approached the Students for Life table, took one of the fetal models, the rubber fetal models, went to Planned Parenthood, was going to have an abortion. Jessica walked out of the Planned Parenthood abortion facility after they told her, you have to do this. You're Latina. You're the first one in your family to graduate college. You're not going to achieve your goals. So she walked out. And the next week, she found the Students for Life group again on campus, tabling about abortion, tabling about nonviolent alternatives in her community, walked right up to them and said, okay, now what do I do? I'm not going to have this abortion. Now what do I do? And it's an incredible story of just how the entire Fresno State Students for Life group came around this young mother, helped her through, went with her to university meetings where they had to kind of stand up for her rights as a pregnant student on campus. Jessica eventually became the president of the Students for Life group as a mother, walked in her master's graduation with her son with her. It's an incredible story. And there's all kinds of stories like that of just having that presence on campus as a Students for Life group, highlighting all that's there that the group is willing to do, whether it's baby diaper drives, baby showers, free babysitting nights that these Students for Life groups do. They're that voice to say, you don't have to make this false choice. You don't have to choose between your education or the way you see your life going and your child. You can do both. It's not going to be easy, but you can do both.
You know, I'm stuck back at what you said a moment ago about how they try to tell this young lady that if she has a baby, she will destroy her life.
That's right.
I mean, what I'm hearing is if you're a mom, you're a loser. And it's so bizarre.
It's antiquated.
It's that, but it's also so bizarre that they've been able to achieve a certain level of dividing a mother from her baby.
Yeah.
It's so contrary to God's nature. A mom has that desire. She has that nature and that nurture to be there for that baby. And it's kind of profound in a sad way that they have done such devastation to that natural ability of a mom. And to label that person, you're not going to succeed. You can do it today. Yeah. You can do it. You can have a career. You can be a mom. You can get married, which is a better way to go, right? Mm-hmm. And yet I do think they're unfortunately successful in brainwashing young women that they will never succeed if they have a baby. What a lie from the pit of hell.
No, and that lie didn't just start you know, recently. I mean, you think about the 1960s and in the second wave of the feminist movement, and how, you know, in the 70s, you started seeing advertising, marketing in America shift from a mother being this put together, nicely dressed woman who can handle it all to becoming this disheveled person. And the career woman is the one who's put together and has it all going on. And I mean, that started way before I was even conceived or thought of. And that's what we've seen on these campuses. And we call it, when I'm speaking to young women, I'll ask them, why are you falling for these antiquated lies of the abortion industry? You know you're strong enough. You know, we've been told, you know, since we were little girls in schools, that we are equal to boys and we can achieve, you know, even more than boys can achieve. And if you look at the college, you know, graduation rates, more women are graduating college now than men. So, I mean, that's a whole nother problem and a whole nother broadcast and expert you need to bring on there. But why do you feel that you have to succumb to these lies of the abortion industry? Yeah. Abortion is the opposite of empowerment to young women.
Truly is. Mm-hmm. And I'm so proud of what pregnancy resource centers do around the country. It's an awesome movement. They are there for that woman to help her in so many practical ways. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get that at a Planned Parenthood clinic, sorry, or any other abortion clinic. They're into making the money off the abortion, and you're out the door. Yep. And that's the plain truth. Kristen, I want to kind of get into that moment that you're on a campus and you're having these exchanges with students that, you know, it's almost, there is a, my expression of this, there's almost, I've seen the videos on YouTube, it's almost like a militancy and a block uniform think that they show up in. You know, it's the typical congregation of thinkers on the left, you know, the LGBTQ crowd and the pro-abortion people. And by the way, I no longer call them pro-choice. That is an accurate statement.
I've only been campaigning for that for 15 years.
Pro-abortion.
That's right.
So, you know, I think all of us in the Christian community don't give them the dignity of choice. That's not what they're about, ever. They're about $600,
$700. They get very angry when you say that, though.
Right, but it's not. It's a lofty-sounding title, but it's not who they are.
No, that's right.
And especially the leaders of that movement. But describe being in that kind of angry, aggressive context. I mean, you know, for me, I do want to have a discussion. I want to keep the dialogue open. The Lord, I think, really does command us to maintain that. But boy, our own temperament, the way that we're wired, can really trip us up in that environment where there's unloading of this emotion coming at us. How do you frame it? How do you go about engaging with somebody who's frothing at the mouth and seemingly want to hurt you because of what it is you believe?
Well, I'm very lucky. I mean, my singular prayer usually when I step onto an environment like that is, come Holy Spirit, you know, so. It's a good start. And, you know, words will come out of my mouth sometimes and I'll watch the video later. I'm like, oh man, where did that come from? It was not in any written remarks I had or thoughts I was having. And so the Holy Spirit does come. And I think He gives you that sense of peace and calm when you're having those discussions. I think, you know, for me, when I'm having that discussion with a young person, especially when they get really angry, you have to understand you're probably talking to a walking wounded person. I mean, with the rate of abortion in our country, likely that person's been involved in abortion or has had an abortion or knows someone they love who's had an abortion. And so there's some sort of hurt there. Often I get young people, and this, I know this is an issue close to your heart, Jim, who have been raised in the foster care system, and they're very hurt by what their parents did to them, by something that happened to them in the system. And they're there, and sadly, they'll say, well, I don't think anybody has any value. I don't have any value. Mm-hmm. And so you're dealing with somebody who's, it's not just arguing a political argument about abortion or even a human rights argument about this child that they'll never know. It's having an argument with themselves that they have value. And, you know, I have to start out all my speeches on campuses now reminding students that they have value. Like
themselves.
Yes. Yeah. I give a pregnancy helpline for standingwithyou.org, which is our kind of comprehensive resource of pregnancy centers and government funded non-abortion agencies. I talk about post-abortive healing. And then I always end with, and you have value. No matter how much you hate me or how much you may disagree with me, I want you to know that I believe you have value and you had a right to be born. Those are like the three standard things I have to always, you know, make sure I go through. And so I think that helps have peace in those conversations when someone's screaming at you or, you know, calling me nasty names or threatening my children. I tend to get more, I guess, angry when it's a person who comes up. I'm thinking about my last campus I was at this fall semester, University of Florida, where a young man who kept professing his Christian faith and using it to justify abortion. I think I probably lost my cool on that one.
It's
with Christians that I tend to lose my my coolness with, because I'm like, you should know better. You know, of all the things, why are you quoting scripture to me, trying to justify killing God's children? I think that helps. I also think we're all called to different things too. I am much better in a hostile situation where people are screaming at me, because
you're pretty calm.
I'm calm, and I'm also thinking about what I'm saying and what people who are watching the conversation are thinking. Because often I have 50 students who are watching the conversation. So I'm pointing out the illogic position that they have taken. And I get to see, I have the best view in the whole deal, because I get to see the little light bulbs go off in all the audiences. You know, one story I also remember just recently, where I was speaking at a pregnancy center event, and I was kind of questioning in my mind my life choices of why I was spending another night away from my family. I think the center was doing such a great job. I'm like, you don't need me to come up there. You could have done it without. And so I got up, I gave my speech. I was like, all right, I got to get driving home. And a young girl came up to me and said, you know, I came here to meet you tonight. And I thought she was one of the clients from the pregnancy center. She has a beautiful little boy on her hip. And I said, oh, it's so great to meet you. Thanks for coming out to meet me. And she goes, oh, I said, oh, are you a client here? Did they help you with your son? And she said, oh, no. I heard about this online, but I had to come here to meet you. And usually when people say that, that could be a bad thing in my line of work. But I realized with the baby, I was pretty safe. And I said, oh, that's nice. Why did you come? Why did you want to come meet me? And she said, well, I just wanted to introduce you to baby Hudson. I was going to have an abortion. And I saw a flyer that one of your Students for Life groups had on my campus. And I suddenly found myself on YouTube, and I watched all of these videos of you. And I just knew I couldn't do that. And so suddenly Hudson became the fifth most beautiful baby I've ever seen in my entire life after my four children. It was an incredible story, a good reminder for me of how, you know, God has puts us where he wants us. You know, I was like, all right, God, all right, this is why I travel. This is why I do what I do away from my family.
And there's probably many more women that have that same testimony.
Absolutely. And it's just the power of that video, you know, of being out there, of showing the other side of the argument. And women, you never know who's going to watch any of these videos. It's quite interesting. I've had people come up to me and say, you know, I don't think you should put out videos on the internet, because, you know, we're Christians and your videos basically make a fool out of the other person. And I'm like, well, we're not mean to the other person. I think their arguments are certainly foolish, and we can laugh at some illogical statement someone says. But I think it's very important for people to see that under all of the rhetoric from the abortion lobby of her choice, reproductive freedom, really there's no logic there and there's no science there. Mm-hmm. And those videos have changed thousands of minds and have saved, you know, certainly saved baby Hudson and saved hundreds of others.
Well, and the only other observation of that is what a brilliant way to mute the church to, why would you talk about that? We need to talk about it. God's truth is a two-edged sword, right?
That's right.
His word. And it will pierce your heart. Like so many students that you've encountered, the light bulbs go on.
That's right.
And they know truth, maybe for the first time.
Yeah. And you have to be, you know, you have to be willing to say the truth.
Well, and that's what's so good.
Yeah.
Let me address, for the audience particularly, this young man you encountered at University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because within the Christian context, and I'll use the broader definition of that, there are some people who profess Christ but do support abortion. I came across something from my good friend John Stonestreet, who's the president of the Colson Center. And he uses this in his talks. It's something called the Didache, which is written, they believe, about 100 A.D., these were the teachings of the early church, from the disciples to those who became Christians. And it's kind of the manual before the canonization of Scripture of what to do and not to do. And this is a direct quote from the Didache. You can go online, look it up. It kind of runs through the Ten Commandments and helps illustrate to the early church what we need to do to be in good stead as Christians. And in, I think it's section 2 in the Didache, point 2, thou shalt not procure abortion. This is 100 AD. That's the very word, because they could create something like Pitocin, which was an early dilator, and you could abort your child. And they did it through natural means. He goes on to say, nor commit infanticide. So for those believers who don't think that the church had a stance on this, read the Didache. Thou shalt not procure an abortion or commit infanticide. Be learned about what it is you profess before you talk about it. And I just want to make sure people read. I mean, that's right from the early church papers. So,
I wish you were with me. You could have been with me in Gainesville.
But it's such a great point. If you think you know what the faith's all about, you better know. And anyway, that's something for me when I hear Christians, they're speaking out of their ignorance. Out of what
I eventually got the young man to tell me that he didn't think that slavery was unbiblical and that, you know, slavery in some circumstances could be a good for a person too. So after I got him to that point, I just looked around to the rest of the group and said, who do you want to listen to, or him?
Right. And in that context, one of the things that you speak to is that analogy that this is a modern day version. Explain how you can correlate that to the post-Dobbs environment, that we're like where the country was when it came to slavery. How do you make that assessment?
Well, I think, you know, thinking back to the end of the Civil War, it took 99 years from the surrender of Appomattox to the signing of the Civil Rights Act, which I think, you know, Martin Luther King, you know, was referring to when he was talking about the positive peace in his letter from Birmingham Jail. Where he,
can I just add that that was 3,000-year-old industry, slavery. Didn't start in the U.S.
That's right.
But 3,000-year-old industry that came to its knees in 99 years with the Constitution.
That's right. And so, you know, when I think about where we go as a pro-life movement in post-Roe America, my prayer is that it does not take us 99 years to see constitutional protection for these pre-born children, right? That we have a lot of work that we have to do. And I think, you know, thinking back to what happened after slavery was ended in our country and the mistakes that we made in our country, you know, looking the other way, those in power looking the other way to the Ku Klux Klan and the rise of those in the South who sought to kill people they felt were unworthy of life.
Well, and not bestowing humanity on the slaves. Right. They were not counted as fully human. Terrible, just like the preborn child.
And I mean, every time you look at human rights abuse throughout history, there's always, I mean, you think of the steps of genocide, right? I think there's like 7 or 8 steps, they say, of, for how genocide takes root. And there's always at the core of it, it's the dehumanization of another human being. And we saw that in the Holocaust, we saw it in slavery, we saw it in the Armenian genocide. I mean, any genocide you think of, the Rwandan genocide, right? And we know there's always dehumanization of another human that has to happen. And then, you know, we've had this end of abortion in sense of Roe, where abortion's still permitted in half of our states across the country. And it's, you know, now trafficked illegally, even to states that are, do not permit it through chemical abortion pills that are killing women and harming them, not only their children. But now we have to think about what's next. And I'm looking at what happened after the end of the Civil War. You know, slavery was illegal, but still terrible things happened. There were still families
of
hurting. And so I think when that's really our, where I get our strategy of what, where do we go in this post-Roe era of, we need to make sure our resources, our pregnancy centers, our maternity homes, our adoption agencies, largely people do not know how much the pro-life movement does. We door knocked last year more than 100,000 homes and neighborhoods surrounding 20 abortion facilities. 73 to 75% of the people we met had never heard of a pregnancy center.
Yeah.
So how are we going to get people to change their minds on abortion and to listen to anything that pro-lifers have to say if they think we don't care and that we haven't been sustaining a social safety net, you know, for the 49 years?
It's a pretty profound context to look at it that way. Like, the pregnancy resource centers are part of the Underground Railroad.
That's right.
To help save these babies.
Right.
Come to us. We will help. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I often say is the antiquated nature of that allegation that pro-abortion people throw, which is you're all about the baby, not the woman. That's a 1973 argument.
That's right.
And that may have been true at the beginning of Roe v. Wade, but totally the church, thankfully, and really in many ways led by the Catholic community. And Protestants came along, but it took a little while for us to catch up. But to really promote a life mm-hmm. perspective and to help the mothers, mm-hmm. which, my goodness, again, you want help as a mom, go to a pregnancy resource center. Mm-hmm. They're going to help you with job training, job That's placement, right. cribs, formula, diapers. I mean, they are there. You are not going to get that at Planned Parenthood.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about ending abortion, corporate abortion in our nation, Planned Parenthood's over a $2 billion industry every year, getting more than $600 million of our taxpayer funds.
That chaps me. I mean,
so it's hard even flying into Colorado. And I think about all that Colorado has done recently. It's such a beautiful state and then has this like mar of abortion over it. It's terrible. But I think about this as a supply and demand issue, right? The pregnancy center movement, the maternity homes, we're reducing the demand for abortion. What we do on college campuses of changing minds, what we do online to change minds and to build up this generation of young people to critically think about abortion, that's reducing demand. But we also have to reduce supply. I mean, that's why we, you know, involve ourselves in 40 Days for Life campaigns and prayer and vigils and sidewalk advocacy in front of Planned Parenthoods. That's why we investigate them. That's why we engage at Students for Life Action into state level lobbying and legislation, you know, because you have to look at this issue as supply and demand.
You know, I'm thinking about one of the difficult questions that we will get from the abortion community is, what about a woman who's raped or is violated mm-hmm. with incest and they're pregnant because of those situations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the number was 1 or 2% of abortions fall into that category, but it's always the first argument that's made on a debate stage.
It's a very disingenuous argument, I find.
Talk to me about that. How, with college students, you probably answered this 1,000 times.
Yeah, there's really only like 10 arguments for abortion. And if I'm at Harvard and Berkeley or a community college or high school, I get the same 10 arguments.
Yeah.
Sometimes they use bigger words, but it's always the same 10 arguments.
Yeah, that's the Harvard crew.
Actually, Dartmouth was the worst. But
okay,
yeah,
there you go.
Harvard was actually nicer. But it's a very disingenuous argument, I find, because often I'll say, you know, I can't think of a worse horror for my daughter, for myself, for my mother, my best friend, than to undergo a sexual assault and have to survive sexual assault. And I think we all can agree that we as a society need to do a better job of supporting women who've survived sexual assault and coming alongside of her. But often I'll try to stop the conversation there and I'll ask the person, well, I hear your question and I'd like to answer your question, but let me first ask you a question. Do you agree with me that 97% of all abortions should be ended in our country that aren't committed because of rape or incest or the life of the mother is at risk?
And that would be about 3%.
That's about 3%. So there's 97% of abortions are being committed because of convenience issues, right? She's lost her job. Her boyfriend's driving her and saying, I'm going to kick you out of her home. These are terrible circumstances, but those aren't life and death circumstances. So would you back up? Let's see if we have common ground. Would you agree that those 97% of abortions should not be committed? I've only ever had one person on campus say yes.
Wow.
And then
what an honest student.
And yeah, and she was by herself. The reason she said yes was she didn't have her friends with her. But I always found that interesting. And I tried to point out to the students, say, you know, I'm going to answer your question, but why are you trotting out the horror of rape survivors, women who've experienced sexual assault and survived, to justify your position, which now we've clarified is that you want all abortions? Why are you doing that? Why can't you just come out and justify abortion because you think it's a woman's body or she has the right to choose to do whatever, or you think a fetus in a womb has no value? Why do you have to use her and her trauma to justify your position?
Yeah.
Don't you feel a little bad about that?
Yeah.
So then I let that marinate for a little bit, and then I'll answer their question about rape. Yeah. But no, we don't think abortion in cases of rape is moral. We don't think it should be legal. I have friends who were conceived in a sexual assault situation.
Wow.
And they will tell you they'll tell anyone that their life has value and they have a wonderful life, and that they're so glad that their mother chose life. I think we're selling women short when we're talking about women who've survived sexual assault. They have survived the worst thing, that most unimaginable thing that I can think of for women. Why are you then telling them that they have to kill their child? That's part of their DNA.
Right.
In order to, it's like this social justice laziness, I like to think of it, of we like to say, we want to say that we are standing with women who survive sexual assault. But what we're really doing is handing her $500 and telling her to go to an abortion clinic to have it get taken care of. But that doesn't end the trauma that she's experienced. It's not going to make her forget about the rape or the rapist or what's happened in her life. You're only potentially compounding that trauma. And the studies you've yeah. studied and we know about abortion is women have trauma when they have abortion,
yeah.
even if it's a pregnancy that they didn't want to have. And I think, you know, we have to do a better job in our country of punishing rapists. And, you know, one of the crimes he should also be punishing for is forcing her to become a mother. But I don't think that justifies one terrible thing happening to you, justifies you committing another terrible thing on another human being.
Yeah, that is a strong argument. And when people, you know, think about it, it, I think, becomes clearer in that regard. But it is a very difficult situation. But again, we're talking about, in that case, rape and incest, less than 2%.
Yeah, like you're 1%. Talking less than 2% abortions. About one study, and there's not a lot of good studies about this. We don't have a national abortion reporting law in our country because the abortion industry won't allow it. But the studies that I've seen, it's about 5% of women who are sexually assaulted can become and will become pregnant. But what's interesting and what no one on campus can ever answer, I'll ask them to say, if these 5% of women who become pregnant with sexual assault, how many of them, what's the percentage of them that choose abortion?
Yeah.
Everyone says it's 100. It's not. It's 50 or less than 50% choose abortion.
Yeah. Think of that. Let me go back for a minute to the early church. I love that history because, you know, my wife did chemistry and she talks about, you know, with the genes, the gene pool, you mm-hmm. know, the clarity of the early gene pool, you know, and what it means. It probably was able to fend off cancer and other things because the earlier in the gene pool, the chromosomes are healthier, and you get a view of what is supposed to be right. And so I look at the early church as that. We should be looking at what they spoke about, what they did as being closest to the teacher, to Jesus, right? They would know best, the disciples and those that followed the disciples. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that again, that didache, one of the things that they were doing as a church was really to help people. Orthopraxy, the doing of the word, not just the speaking of truth. So they engaged. I mean, they would go in the Roman Empire. It was common if you have a baby girl to throw that baby out at the dump. And that baby was left to exposure and, you know, tragic loss of life. And the Christians would wait for those women to come and dispose of their unwanted child and would scoop them up, take them home, and raise them as their own. That's why the passion is there for foster care for me, because mm-hmm. Christians should be the group involved. And I guess, not to be sounding negative, but if we're doing that well, that orthopraxy, especially in this space, helping the pregnancy resource clinics, mm-hmm. talking to women, being engaged in community, looking for that person at the church that might be in trouble, it would speak volumes to what it is we say.
That's right.
So speak to that need for us to apply practical help, to be engaged, and how do we do it?
Yeah. Yeah, I know it's a John Maxwell quote of people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I think, you know, when you look at ending abortion in our country and the stat that I shared earlier about 73 to 75% of folks who live in neighborhoods where they can walk to an abortion facility have never heard of a pregnancy center. So I think it's more than just doing. It's also more saying what we're doing. We tend as Christians to be like, well, we're going to do the work and leave it, you know, God will spread the word. Well, God also gave us loud mouths and good fingers to type. We need to do a better job as Christians of telling the world what it is we do and what we're about. Because I think that not only are you going to help more women come to those resources and families come to those practical resources, but you will lead people to the truth about abortion when they learn what it is fully that the pro-life movement does. At Students for Life, we created the Campaign for Abortion-Free Cities. It's kind of our alumni program of tens of thousands of alumni now. And also grassroots activists of any age can join us. We're not ageist at Students for Life, but we're actually going door to door and we're recruiting community volunteers in cities all across America. We use a campaign approach, the things I've learned in political, you know, campaigning, but
interesting,
we're,
yeah.
And we apply that technology to go door to door. But instead of saying, will you vote for this candidate that you may or may not like yourself? We're saying, hey, did you know that there's a pregnancy center in this town? Here's a chart of everything they provide. Here's a little chart of what Planned Parenthood provides. By the way, do you know Planned Parenthood's under investigation in your town for X, Y, and Z? Would you like some help? And in some of the cities, in the summer we did this particularly, we had a wagon behind us filled with diapers, wipes, and formulas, where if we were meeting a family at the door, they'd say, wait a minute, I never heard about this. And we're like, oh, well, that's what we are. We advertise our, we have a standingwithyou.org website where we have all the pregnancy centers, maternity homes, governmental resources, all in one place. And we show them all the resources that we have online that's in their community. And sometimes we have them right at the door for them. I mean, can you imagine someone showing up to your door? I mean, we've had these amazing stories at the campaign where, you know, a girl will answer the door and say, how did you know? How did you know I was going to the abortion facility? Like, we didn't know. Or there was a door, the campaign hit a door in Cincinnati a couple of months ago where a grandfather said, you need to get in your car and go to this address. My granddaughter's about ready to have an abortion. I can't talk her out of it. And we're showing up the door saying, hey, we're the pro-life movement. We love you. We want to support you.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, anyone who's listening to this needs to sign up. It's abortionfreecities.org. Like I said, we train folks of all ages because this is tangible work. Like,
yeah,
we measure the number of women and families we can refer to pregnancy centers, the conversations we're having. It's great.
Let me ask you about the statistic I've seen recently. I think we're nearing 100,000 babies that have been saved because states have restricted abortion, right, like Texas and Oklahoma and Florida and other places where they've put legislation in place to draw a bright line that no abortion will occur after a certain number of weeks, or like in Oklahoma, no abortion.
Yeah.
And, you know, oh man, are those governors taking it on the chin because of that? But I think the number would be somewhere close to about 100,000 babies now who have been born, who will live life. They'll have their chance. They'll hopefully come to know Jesus as their Savior and, you know, be productive people. It's going to become more difficult, I think, for the left to justify taking the life of a baby when you start seeing 100,000, 200,000, a million babies from these predominantly red states that they have supported life, and they will be the proof in the pudding.
They will.
You would have eliminated these people for whatever reason, and it's immoral.
Yeah, I'm so proud. We wrote that bill in Oklahoma that ended all abortions.
Governor Stitt, what a champion.
It did not even have a rape exception in it. I personally lost friends because we did not put an exception in the bill to allow abortion in cases of rape. Governor Stitt signed that bill. We gave him an award. He was actually here in Colorado speaking. I chased him down with a little award for him. He was so courageous. And those members of the Oklahoma legislature did such a great, incredible job. But yeah, I think, you know, I don't think social scientists have fully thought about or even investigated what this effect of Roe being reversed is going to be. My children are going to grow up in a state where abortion is illegal. If God forbid they choose to go to California or somewhere for college, you know, they will enter a state and they will meet friends that will say, wait a minute, you don't have abortions in your state? You know, I don't think we fully investigated the cultural change of those conversations in the dormitories and the cafeterias where you have kids that will have grown up their whole lives in an abortion-free state and are going to go to a state that's a free-to-kill state.
Yeah.
And the conversation, I mean, wait a minute, you have California's so regressive that you still think you can kill babies?
Right.
Why would you, you know, I can't wait to like just be able to fly on the wall to those conversations that start happening in a few years where, because, you know, these kids are growing up in the red states, right?
Let's just say pro-life states.
Pro-life yeah. states.
That's good.
Their whole worldview is going to be changed about abortion. They're going to know from the moment they're in school that, no, it is not okay to kill an innocent other person simply because they're inconvenient to you, no matter how small they are. And then in other states, regressive places allow you to kill a baby?
Well, and in that context, here's a little biblical theory I have, I think is applicable, that I think God's shalom, his peace, follows his principles. So I think these states that are embracing life, I think you will see a greater chasm develop in terms of human flourishing in these states that are addressing this issue and being a bastion of life versus the death states, as I call them now, where, you know, it's a 50-50 chance if you make it through the birth canal. And I think that chaos, that social chaos that's created, you're going to see more crime, more upheaval, more disrespect, more elderly that are harmed, probably more euthanasia, because we don't really care about life, to be quite frank. It doesn't matter to us, and we want to end your life if you'd like that to happen, or your babies. That is a destructive course, and I think, again, I believe in God's principles. I don't think you can cover them up. They will continue to emerge in the human heart. And I think that's the future. I hope that people can see a distinction. I think it'll be bright.
I hope so. It's so heartbreaking to think that we have half our countries free to be born and half our countries free to kill.
Think of that.
You think about that, and you think about context of leading up to the Civil War. I'm a history person. So leading up to the Civil War, where you had slave states and free states, or later, one ideology is going to win over the other. I don't believe we will forever be a country that's split on this issue. That's why you see Planned Parenthood, like we passed a bill not long ago in Arkansas, life and conception bill, and you know they're suing. And you would think, why does Planned Parenthood care about Arkansas? They had relatively low number of abortions. They had one abortion facility. In terms of like cost, it's pretty expensive.
It's a statement cost.
Yeah, but it's a statement. Because they know they can't, their ideology dictates that they've got to spread this culture of death throughout all of our country. They can't afford to just lose states. And that's why we have to fight harder. I hate when people kind of say, you don't need to do too much in California or Washington or Colorado. Those states are totally gone.
Yeah.
No, those are the states we need to be investing the most amount of money in, right?
Christian, we can't avoid the emerging problem with chemical abortion. And the reason I say the emerging problem is that more and more abortion is being obtained through chemical abortion.
More than half now.
And it's on the rise. Yep. And I think what people need to understand is this is, in some states, again, these death states, a woman doesn't even need doctor's oversight and approval. And it's dangerous.
Yes.
5% of women will have significant issues in doing it. And so I think, first of all, describe what chemical abortion is so that we understand it. And then what is the circumstance of that woman when she's, in essence, I'm sorry for the graphic nature of this, but that baby is being aborted, usually in the bathroom of that woman's apartment or home, and it's going right into the toilet.
That's right. And she's told that. And you don't even have to be pro-life to know that those abortions are heinous. You can go to TikTok, actually, and just type in abortion pills, and you'll see tons of videos from pro-choice girls who'll say that they don't regret their abortion, but they are doing a video warning other girls about the heinous nature of chemical abortion pills and how they all felt that they were going to die. No one talks about chemical abortion
pills. And without
pills.
Any medical
That's right.
personnel
These pills
being present.
Lead to injury, infertility, and death of women. 15% of these chemical abortions are incomplete, meaning she should and needs to seek medical care to make sure all of the contents of her uterus, the child, the placenta is removed so she doesn't become septic and die. They are the drug of choice of sex abusers to cover up their crimes and continue their heinous acts, and they're harming our environment. These are bad, bad drugs. And what we've seen with the Biden administration, they really used COVID as an excuse to push these drugs and drop all of the risk evaluation mitigation strategies. They're called REMS. There's about 70 or 80 drugs that the FDA will approve, but they'll put a black box warning on them and attach REMS because they're so dangerous to those who consume them. And during COVID, they dropped all of them. These REMS were given down by the Clinton administration. They were upheld by the Obama administration. But what changed? nothing changed. It's that the abortion industry knew that Roe was going to be reversed, that brick and mortar abortion facilities are soon going to be a thing of the past, and they needed to move into this new market for themselves. Chemical abortion pills right now in the country usually is a cocktail of two pills. The first pill starves the child, stops the hormone production. The second pill expels the child. She does not have the abortion at the abortion facility. She is told when the bleeding gets too much to sit on the toilet and get in the bathtub, not to look and flush. There are stories after stories. We have young girls who will come up to us on campuses and will show us the picture of their babies in the bathtub because some women look. And there was a video we just shared not long ago of a woman who had four abortions who talked about her last abortion, about how she actually saw her child, arms and limbs. And these are women that then have to relive the scene of the crime every day because they killed their baby
Left alone to dispose of that.
And they're flushing them down the toilet, which, by the way, with these chemical abortion pills, there's actually three active metabolites in these pills that do not go inactive after they pass her body. So when she flushes the toilet, we have chemically tainted blood, tissue, and fetal remains that are going into our wastewater systems that are known endocrine disruptors for aquatic life and animal life. No one ever talks about that. So we talk about all of that on Students for Life. When we're on campuses, when we're online, making the point that, you know, the FDA, those in charge of trying to supposed to be protecting Americans are failing us because they've fallen for this abortion agenda. We're talking to young girls about, you know, the dangers of this drug. And sadly, women who've experienced abortions themselves are doing even a better job than we are of telling women about how horrible and horrific these drugs are. I mean, your granddaughter, your child can be getting these drugs, ordering them in a matter of 5 minutes.
Yeah, mail order.
I can go to a couple of websites without ever even proving that I'm pregnant, without even proving that I'm a female, proving that I'm not a rapist, order the drugs and get them delivered to my door or friend's door. This is dangerous. And we need state attorneys general to stand up, to stop the flow, to punish these pharmaceutical companies. They're allowing these drugs to get into these hands. Every Walgreens, Rite Aid, and CVS in our country now is an abortion facility. I get this queasy feeling in my stomach when I go in front of a Planned Parenthood. I don't enjoy praying in front of a Planned Parenthood style counseling. I get very nauseated. I get that exact same feeling now when I walk into a CVS or Rite Aid.
Because, wow, it's a powerful way to say it.
I mean, the girl in front of me in line could be getting a pill and could be moments away from going to her car, popping the first pill and killing her child. That's at the CVS.
Yeah, that's sobering. Let's end here with the idea that someday there can be federal legislation that makes abortion illegal nationwide. Seems far away. I think the overturning of Roe v. Wade seemed far away. That was a 50-year battle. Mm-hmm. But I, like you, do believe that people will come to their senses and say, this is inhumane. Mm-hmm. We cannot kill off our next generation. How long will that take in your view, and do you see it that way?
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be federal legislation. It could also be just a simple recognition from Congress. We introduced the Life of Conception Act again this year that simply says, as stated in the 14th Amendment, the government has the duty to protect persons living in its country and, you know, allowing that those persons the right to live. So it's actually can simple 14th Amendment protections. You can make that legal argument. So
yeah, personhood.
Yeah. I mean, it could be a simple act of Congress saying, yeah, that's right. Preborn children are protected by the 14th Amendment. It could be a federal bill. It could be a federal amendment added to our Constitution. You know, why do I continue to build up this army of young people? Well, because I know this is going to be a long fight and I need them in every level of government. That's why we started our 501c4 political arm a few years ago, Students for Life Action, where we're getting our young people to run for office and win, because we're going to need 37 state legislatures to ratify the amendment that, you know, if we go the amendment route. There's a lot of different routes we can go in the pro-life.
But changing the heart of the culture is the key.
Absolutely.
Waking people up. And that's what I so appreciate about what you are doing, what you've been doing for 18 years now through Students for Life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the hope. The hope is kind of it would be a revival in this space, particularly. Mm-hmm. The other comment I'd like to have you make, and then we'll close it. But so many people who are, I would say, more on the pro-abortion side, critical of the pro-life community because you're involved in politics.
Yeah.
I would say, and we've been saying at Focus for over 40 years, this is a moral issue.
It's a human rights issue.
The political arena took it over with Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm. and that's why it's bouncing in that arena. But this is about the heart of the culture in terms of how do we treat one another? How do you respond to that, that this is political and the church shouldn't be involved in the political arena?
Yeah, I mean, this is a human rights issue at the end of the day. And there's multiple ways we fight human rights issues, right? Where we have the service side, the practical service. We've got the culture change, changing minds. And yeah, we change laws because guess what? Laws change culture too. Culture just doesn't change laws. Laws change culture. Look at the polling after Roe versus Wade was handed down, the view of Americans about abortion. The view that Americans held largely before Roe was handed down was that abortion was immoral in most cases. After Roe, it skyrocketed in the other direction. Why? Because people saw the law as a teacher. And I mean, I think we have lots of demonstrated cases throughout American history where we should not be, you know, holding up the law as our moral teacher, where we've had it wrong many times. So I think it's, we do all of the things. And that's what we teach our students at Students for Life to do is we have, you know, five areas we ask each Students for Life to, you know, group to engage on to be well-rounded advocates. And the thing is, you don't have to be involved in politics. You can be a pro-lifer, just votes, please vote, always vote pro-life first. But you don't ever have to go door knocking for a candidate you don't like or donate. You can be involved in the service aspect. This movement is so large that no matter who you are, your experience, your story, your gifts that God gave you. I mean, who would have thought like a loudmouth like me could, you know, do what I do?
Self-proclaimed.
Right? Yes. I mean, everyone has these gifts, these spiritual gifts that we've been given, and you can find your place in the pro-life movement. Don't let that like politics, you don't want to be involved in politics, be the excuse for you not to act.
Yeah.
Because then I would believe you're making an immoral act.
No, it's so good. And, you know, again, one of the things that we've done for years here is that option ultrasound, but that now has expanded into so many efforts within the pro-life community. Yes. For example, certainly the placement of the machines in the clinics, but also developing a powerful app, My Choice Network, that gets all the independent pregnancy resource centers kind of connected in community, and we're able to do national or regional ad campaigns an app when a woman searches abortion, need abortion, and that has exponentially sent women to these clinics to get advice on having the baby and saving the baby's life. That's been powerful. I mean, hundreds of thousands of appointments in the pro-life community. That's been a great success. The other, which we hadn't talked about, but it's something I've thought about going all the way back during the Obama administration. We always talk about women keeping that child, but adoption is an option, a better option than ending the life of your child. But one of the difficulties we have is we don't have a national kind of adoption, waiting adoption list of parents who want a newborn infant. So we are attempting to work with agencies, adoption agencies, to develop a national database.
That's fantastic.
And if we can, you know, there's about a million abortions every year. And from our research, about a million people that would do the adoption. We just need to link these up. So we're working hard in that same space with Option Ultrasound to put money toward developing that list so that women will have options, pre-qualified adoptive parents who are Christians and want to get involved in this way. That is another noble approach.
That's right. And I'm so thankful for what you're doing because that's so, so needed. I just interviewed a woman a couple months ago on my podcast, Explicitly Pro-Life.
And say it again.
Explicitly Pro-Life.
Yeah.
And she's a foster care advocate in Jacksonville, child psychologist, and just talking about what's happening in the foster care system in Florida and how hard it was for her family to adopt a child and the blessing of her child that she was able to adopt. It should not be this hard. But you think about politics. Politics is a place to engage in that.
Yeah.
You know, we need better state laws about, to help adopting families. The rising costs of adoption in our country. We don't talk about those things a lot. There needs to be folks coming together to address some of the real concerns we have, you know, and folks have with the foster care agencies in states or how, you know, the
Christians are being sidelined in some of these states from adopting or from being in foster care.
Exactly.
It's horrible. But this is so good. And here's an irony. You know, we have got the metrics down. It's $60 to save a baby's life through the Option Ultrasound program that I've talked about. So I hope people will engage that way. Jean and I are doing that. You know, we try to do that every month to save babies through the program. And
you can change a young person's mind about abortion for $12 a
month. Hey, I'm in.
If you do that,
let's do that. I'll support you.
I'll match you and you match me.
That'll be great. And, you know, again, this is just a way to engage in all of the great work that's being done. Kristen, it's important to mention the fact that another thing that we're involved with, along with the Pregnancy Resource Centers, is the abortion reversal pill. So this is a very safe thing to do. Once a woman has taken that first pill, they can get the reversal pill if they do within about 24 or 48 hours. It can actually restore the baby and no harm. There's long-term studies that have watched this. I think 5,000 babies were looked at clinically, all solid, healthy children. And this is all hormone treatment. They blast the baby with a hormone in order to start the process, and then you can reverse that.
That's right.
So I would encourage women who are maybe in that spot to think about quickly, and you can get a hold of a Pregnancy Resource Center. Call 1-800-A-FAMILY. We could put you in touch with somebody right away, and a nurse will be on the line with you.
Yeah, that's awesome. And go to standingwithyou.org and start a chat with Heartbeat International instantly. And they're the ones who founded the Abortion Pill Reversal Network, and they can get the protocol going.
Kristen, thank you for what you do. I'm so delighted that we could have you on Refocus so that you could express what you're seeing at the ground level. There's nothing that beats being on the ground and talking with people. And I admire the fact that you're doing it. I'd encourage people to take a look at your YouTubes because those are really good instructors on how to deal with angry people in your face and the way that you're able to, you know, respond to them with logic, with compassion, with spiritual insight. Keep on going.
Well, thank you for what you guys do and your Option Ultrasound. And it's incredible just to hear a refresher of all that Focus of the Family is doing right now to change our culture and save lives and help mothers.
Well, thank the Lord for people with big hearts that give to help this effort and your effort
as well.
So thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Kristen Hawkins shared so much valuable insight, and knowing how to talk about abortion in a firm but compassionate way is going to be crucial as we enter election season and have more opportunities to share with others about the value of pre-born lives. So I hope you feel better equipped to have those productive conversations. And I'd encourage you to get involved with helping women in crisis pregnancies and their pre-born children. As I mentioned in the interview, we have a program called Option Ultrasound that allows abortion-minded women visiting pregnancy centers to receive an ultrasound and counseling for free. And over 54% of women who have counseling and that ultrasound choose life. We estimate that over 500,000 babies have been saved by Option Ultrasound, but many more are at risk, and we need your help to save them. Every $60 you give will help save a baby's life through the Option Ultrasound program. And also, let me add, on June 15th, we'll be having an event called See Life 24 here in Colorado Springs and through live streaming. As the pro-life movement gains that momentum, we'll equip you to connect with your local pregnancy centers and to show the love of Christ to women who are facing a pregnancy crisis. Click the link in the show notes to find out more. Now for the inbox segment, here's a voicemail from Jennifer.
Hello, Jim. I have a cousin who is still in college and recently got pregnant. She's not married and she broke up with the father of her child. She's considering an abortion, but I'm trying to figure out how to warn her away from it without ruining our relationship. Do you have any advice?
Well, Jennifer, that's a tough situation, but I would encourage you to be bold and loving. In that context, she's got some difficult choices to make. I can only speak to the experience I've seen, and that's a woman who actually gives that baby life will have a far better experience than someone who takes the life of their child. So adoption programs are terrific, and there are many Christian adoption agencies she can work with, churches that she should be able to work with. Maybe that's a way to help her, pointing her to a pastor that can talk with her about better choices than terminating the life of her child. And I want to say thank you so much for your question and for listening to the podcast. Man, we'll be praying for that situation because that is life and death. And given I've answered that question, I'll send you a copy of my book, Refocus, Living a Life That Reflects God's Heart. The book's about reaching the culture with the love of Christ and making connections with people who don't know God. And I'd only add, Jennifer, you can't own the outcome. You can only do the best you can do to persuade and to give her more options than she's considering right now. I want to hear about how you're showing God's compassion to unbelievers and what you're experiencing in the culture. Send me a question or let me know how the Refocus podcast has impacted you. And please send me a voicemail by clicking the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to Refocus with Jim Daly. Please tell your friends about Refocus and like, listen, and subscribe wherever you find your podcasts. On the next episode of Refocus, I'll visit with Joe Dallas about cancel culture and speaking truth to people who desperately need to hear it.
Yeah, this is where I stand, but I'd like to understand where you stand better, see where we have some common ground, see if we can exchange ideas, and do so in the context of a respectful relationship.
That's coming up on Monday, April 22nd, on the next Refocus with Jim Daly.
Are you a pastor? Then you know ministry is full of challenges. But those challenges sometimes come from lies that you believe about your role and expectations of you. As a pastor, you and your spouse need to be refreshed and encouraged. And that's why Focus on the Family presents the Focused Pastor Couples Conference. Join us as we hear from Paul David Tripp, Dr. Greg Smalley, Ted Cunningham, and more. Mark your calendar to join us on October 28th through 30th right here at Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs. Visit thefocusedpastor.com/refresh for more details.